Hello from the children of planet Earth.
3, 2, 1, 0. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Hi, I'm Dr. Alan Duffy.
And I'm Dr. Amanda Bauer.
We're astronomers.
And in this podcast, we talk about astronomy that excites us.
Like, for every single atom in the entire universe, there's 5 times more dark matter out there.
That feeling you get when you realize there are a billion dark matter particles passing through you every second? That's what we call cosmic vertigo.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. End of test.
There's a wind blowing through you right now. You can't feel it, you can't see it, you can't hear it. There's no taste or movement of the world around you to tell you that it's there. But through every single one of us is passing around a billion particles of this wind each and every second of our lives. This wind is actually because of our motion, the entire solar system's motion, through the cloud of dark matter that surrounds our galaxy.
What is it?
I don't know.
Give me some details, man.
In our ignorance, we have named it dark matter, a new type of stuff.
We've now reached the part of this podcast series where we talk about things that we can't actually see. We can just infer its existence from how it affects other things. And since we can't see it, we tend to throw names like dark something at it.
Yeah, there's an even bigger dark something coming, but the dark matter, I think, is real. I think it is a new type of particle, very different to the atoms that you and I are made of. It's out there, and we have to just find it.
Yeah, well, we see its effect on lots of different things. I mean, I'm totally with you. I think it's real. There's clear evidence in various parts of our universe, in its entire structure, in how galaxies are distributed, how galaxies were formed, to individual galaxies, to our own Milky Way galaxy. Our own Milky Way galaxy, just based on very simple equations like Newton or even earlier Keplerian physics, you would expect things that are very close to the center to be orbiting around, so stars close, to be orbiting around faster than the stars that are far away from it. You see this very simple principle in our solar system. The planets very close to the sun orbit around much quicker than, say, Pluto. Pluto takes ages. But amazingly, and quite confusingly, when we first found it, when Vera Rubin first found it, she had no idea why she was observing the stars at the outskirts of galaxies to be zooming around the center of the galaxy way faster than they had any business zooming when you add up all of the light emitting stars in the galaxy.
Yeah, so everything we can see, if you add up all the gravity from all of that, there's just not enough gravity, just not enough force to hold on to those distant yet impossibly quickly moving stars. They should just have flown away. They should have escaped.
Yeah, they have enough energy from their velocity that they would just zoom out. They're not stuck based on gravity to that system anymore.
So the ideas at the time, either gravity, as we understand, is wrong, or there's just more gravity there.
There's something causing more gravity. There's more stuff. And what the heck is that stuff?
Yeah, and that stuff, since we can't see it,
is dark.
And it must be matter because it's got gravity. That is literally about as much as we know.
We keep characterizing it, quantifying it, because we see its evidence in more and more parts of the universe. But yeah, what it actually is, still a mystery.
So we have an idea of how much dark matter is out there. We can add up the additional amount of matter required to hold those stars together. And Vera's work was pioneering that she essentially made the, at the time, incredible argument actually, that there's about five times more of this missing stuff to hold on to those stars. And that number is pretty much spot on. That hasn't changed.
Well, she looked quite a few different galaxies in her sample and just kept finding the same thing over and over and over. These stars are just zooming around.
And we've now also gone with radio telescopes to look at the gas that swirls around. Exactly the same. This is not something weird about the stars. Anything we can see that emits light or absorbs light, it all shows that same pattern, that we need extra stuff out there. And that extra stuff can't emit or shine. Like,
yeah,
otherwise we'd see it.
So it only interacts through gravity. Mm. It does not interact at all, electromagnetically. So it produces no light if it sees some other atom flying by, if it sees an electron, a photon, it just doesn't interact with it. It passes right through it. It doesn't collide with things, only gravitational interactions, which kind of makes it really difficult to detect because almost everything we know about the universe comes from the light that comes from stars that gas emits.
So one of our challenges is that this dark matter is a ghost. That idea that it doesn't interact with light also means that as far as the dark matter is concerned, solid matter, the walls, us, the entire Earth, is basically empty space. And that's because the atom is fundamentally almost entirely empty space. The only reason that you're not able to put your hand through the wall is because...
I mean, I'm trying. I'm knocking on this table right now. Look, I'm pinging my wine glass, and my finger is not going through that thing.
Yep.
Not that I'm drinking.
Be careful with that. That's a scientific experiment. We're going to get to why that's important later. The electrons in the atoms of your hand are repelled by the electrons in the atoms of the table, the wine glass, the walls. But that interaction is actually through electromagnetism. That's why like charges repel. They actually emit light, little bits of particles of light that bounce back and forth, and that's actually how you get the sensation of solid matter. But if you don't care about light, then you don't care about this cloud of electrons that give a really big target for these atoms. And instead...
You just zoom right through it.
Because it really is almost entirely empty space. And just to put that in context, if you were to blow up the center, the nucleus of the atom, to about 10 centimeters across, this is about the size of a cricket ball, then the atom, the cloud of electrons that swirl around that give us that sensation of a physical solid object, would be 10 kilometers wide. Little cricket ball, that's where all the mass is, sitting in the middle of a city, which is effectively empty space if you don't know about these electrons, if you don't feel light, if you don't interact electromagnetically. This is why if you go randomly running towards that city, chances are you'll hit something if, you know, it's a 10 kilometer wide city, there's a pretty big target, you're gonna definitely know it's there. But if all you can possibly see is that cricket ball somewhere hidden in that city, there is just no way you'll ever bump into it. That is why dark matter can just fly through solid matter as if it wasn't there, because it really isn't there in terms of presenting a target.
That was the dark matter.
That was uncanny. That's exactly what it would sound like.
Is that what you imagine it sounds like? Yeah.
I think it's more of a... like this ghostly... Ooh.
Oh, yeah.
If you're in the galaxy and you're the sun, you're going around the galaxy 230 kilometers per second. Essentially, you're passing through that cloud of dark matter. And that dark matter individually can be whizzing around in every which way, just like the air in the room is right now. Individual atoms are bouncing around in every direction, but there's no net flow unless you get a breeze. Excellent side effects.
That's all I've got to say about that.
So I like this analogy to describe the headwind, the effect of our sun passing through that cloud of dark matter. Dark matter's minding its own business. Our sun zooms through it. For anyone who's driven in the rain falls down vertically, and yet it appears that that rain comes rushing towards the car windscreen. And that's not because it's moving, it's rather because we're moving through it.
I envision warp speed and zooming through the universe and all the stars go...
Yeah.
There we go. Another sound effect that I think perfectly describes dark matter flashing through your body.
I'm getting more and more convinced about this sound. We have the idea that just like the rain comes rushing towards the car window screen, the dark matter is rushing towards the sun and the Earth and just the solar
passes
system.
Right through you.
And it's able to pass right through like a ghost because it doesn't interact with light. What that means in effect is that you have a wind of dark matter rushing through you at 230 kilometers per second because we know how much dark matter there is, five times more mass. If you pick your favorite dark matter particle, you can figure out how many dark matter particles there are, and then you can figure out how many must be rushing through you, and it's a billion. A billion dark matter particles rushing through your body each and every second, and you will never have felt that.
Nope, we never feel it.
Very occasionally, there is a collision. Very occasionally, that dark matter has a head-on collision with the very center of the atom.
Hopefully not in your body.
Definitely in your body. But you've never noticed it.
Oh, that's what that tickle was. Yeah.
That atom can just get knocked clean out of your body, and it's fine because you take on trillions and trillions of atoms every day, every time you take a breath or eat any food. We make for very poor dark matter detectors, but we're trying to build better ones.
Let's talk about some of the other observational ways that we see dark matter's influence. We've talked about the stars orbiting around a galaxy. There are even bigger structures. In fact, one of the biggest structures in the entire universe is called a galaxy cluster. These are entire galaxies kind of orbiting around each other because this gravity has them stuck together. But as long ago as the 1930s, observations of these galaxies and seeing how fast the galaxies are moving around these clusters started to give a hint that they were actually moving way too fast. Those galaxies shouldn't be stuck together. They should be able to just fly off into space. So again, there must be something else that's not emitting light. It's dark. It's matter. We need to talk about something called gravitational lensing, which is one of the neatest,
it's amazing,
wackiest features of the universe. Imagine looking at these distant galaxy clusters and seeing rings. So not seeing, you know, just your normal spiral, oval-looking galaxies, but then you see these rings of galaxies just stretching out throughout the whole thing. What the heck is that? That would be so, if Einstein hadn't come along and explained the whole freaking thing 100 years ago, that would have been so crazy.
It's an optical illusion. We are seeing a beautiful example of Einstein's theory of general relativity, that gravity, that is mass, a concentration of mass, will bend light around it like a lens.
So if you've got some super distant object, way far away, it's so faint you can't even see it. We can't see it with our most powerful telescopes. But between you and that object, there is something else. And let's say it's a galaxy cluster. And so as you're looking at this galaxy cluster, this ring turns out to be that distant object way far at the edge of the universe. As its light is innocently traveling through the universe, it gets bounced around. It gets stretched around the mass of that galaxy cluster, so that when we see it, we see this distorted, stretched light.
So there's going to be a lot of head scratching going on, but luckily there is a super sophisticated scientific experiment that you can perform at home.
Everyone, right now, just take a moment to go grab a wine glass and come join us again. I've got mine right here.
And it's nigh empty.
If you have a bottle of wine next to you, that would be acceptable.
Empty your wine glass, however you choose to do that.
All right, so I have my wine glass, I have my pen and my piece of paper, and I am going to draw a coin-sized circle and color it in.
So it has to be about the size of the stem of the wine glass, maybe a little bit bigger than the thickness of the stem of your wine glass.
Okay, I can do that.
Oh, yeah, don't have a fancy wine glass. You know those ones where there's actually no stem? And it's like a goblet.
So requirements, you need to have the stem of your wine glass.
And what we're going to do now is put the wine glass over that dot, perfectly centered. And then I want you to look down the wine glass, like straight overhead.
I need
down.
To make my circle a little bigger.
A little bit bigger?
A little bigger.
Okay.
Okay, it's bigger.
So you look down, and what should have been a dot, you'll now see is a circle.
Yeah, it's like a ring.
Yeah.
So down in the center around that stem, I see a ring. My ink is black. So I see a black ring with my little squiggly lines around it.
And that's
But it's a complete circle.
Complete circle.
Yep.
A perfect ring. This is known as an Einstein ring. This is where the background image has been lensed by, in this case, the thickness of the glass, the stem. And it has taken that circle, that perfect circular dot, and it has bent it around, and now you get a beautiful Einstein ring, a perfect circle.
Interestingly, this can get more exciting as the evening goes on, depending on how much you want this experiment to work. If I move my head back and forth, then that ring starts to get distorted. So it loses its complete ring, and it kind of shifts so that there's more of it to the left or more of it to the right, depending on how wobbly I am as I'm moving back and forth, until I move far enough to the side that it's like almost a semicircle, like a half moon or something off to one side.
But you actually get arclets. So the official term for this is an arclet. You'll get a thick side But look at the other side. Do you see the little?
Yeah,
it's
a thin ring.
You until always you get them both.
But oh, until you get too far away. Axis. Once you get too off axis, as it were, off the wine glass.
We haven't been drinking at all.
Don't go too far.
So what we've got is a background image, in this case the dot, in reality, an entire galaxy, very, very, very distant. And we have something that can bend that light between us and that background image. In this case, it's the glass, the wine glass stem. In the universe, it's a whole heap of galaxies.
You can imagine clusters. In the universe, it's not nearly as smooth as a wine glass stem. So this cluster of galaxies is just, you know, there's a galaxy here, galaxy there, galaxy there. Turns out there's a bunch of stuff in between. So you very rarely actually get the perfect Einstein ring. Instead, you get these little skewed ones, but it's not just one. You can see the same distant galaxy with an arc over to one side of the cluster, and you can see it arced onto the other side of the cluster and up and down. You can see 20 arcs of the exact same galaxy as it passes through this choppy cluster.
Yeah, this optical illusion, this distortion of the background object, the background galaxy, it is an amazingly effective way to probe the invisible. Because Einstein's theory tells us you just need mass. You don't care if the mass that's doing the lensing, bending the light, it doesn't have to shine. In fact, it works even better if it doesn't, because then you don't get confused. Instead, you just need there to be gravity. And the one thing that dark matter has
gravity!
Is a lot of gravity. So the thicker the stem of the wine glass, you get more of a lensing effect. The same is true. The more dark matter you're piling into a region, the more of a lensing effect you get. So you can actually weigh that invisible dark matter.
You take these observations and you say, all right, we've got 17 images of this galaxy and it curves in this way. What matter must be in this cluster in order to distort our distant galaxy in that way? You can weigh the galaxy cluster. And surprise, surprise, there's a heck of a lot more stuff there than just what's in the galaxy.
Five times more. Vera Rubin's number.
In every single cluster that we've actually done this measurement in, and this is not an easy measurement. There are people who base their entire careers doing this measurement for cluster after cluster, and thanks to them to take the dedicated time to do it. It's a really difficult observation, but it hasn't failed us yet. This dark matter is consistently there.
And it's not just in and around the objects that we can see. It actually stretches between those objects too. If you look into the night sky, you see these, to quote Hubble, these island universes, these entire galaxies hanging poised and delicately alone and really kind of tragically alone. But if you had eyes that could see this dark matter, you would see the dark matter surrounding those galaxies 10 times bigger on the sky than the galaxy itself. But then you would see that there are bridges of this dark matter between those objects. You can play a cosmic game of join the dots between those galaxies. You can trace out this underlying dark matter filaments, or what we call the cosmic web, where the individual galaxies are just like morning dew on a spider's web in the backyard. They're just dotted along it. And we know that this is true because simulations tell us. Theorists, in my supercomputer simulations of baby universes, you can throw in the dark matter, throw in the gas, the atoms. You can throw in some physics, gravity, basically,
well,
and some other stuff.
It's a good thing we observed this stuff in order for you to, have a job.
I'm very grateful to Vera Rubin. You basically start the simulation and you see the galaxies begin to grow, and they grow within the dark matter structures. That's actually the gravitational backbone around which galaxies grow. In fact, if you didn't have the dark matter in that simulation, and it is super boring if you don't, nothing grows.
Yeah, you wouldn't have galaxies. And this also informs us how much dark matter relative to all the other stuff in the universe, including all the stuff that emits light and that makes stars and planets and coffee and cars. So because of these simulations, we've been able to determine that 27, is that the number right now? 27%?
So
it changes a little bit every
little bit.
Couple years. We get a refinement of it.
So we go, rough breakdown is 5% of the entire, what we call mass energy density of the universe. Or
all the stuff.
All the stuff is, are the atoms. So 5%. Then,
so the atoms, those are the stars and the humans and
yeah, all the
galaxies.
Normal stuff.
Yeah, normal.
So then there's 25%, so five times more of this dark matter. And then the
whatever's left, 70% of the universe.
Eagle-eyed listeners might spot that there's a bit missing in that equation. Yeah, so 70%. That is in the form of dark energy. And we'll talk about that in a future podcast.
Whew. Got to get our energy up to talk about dark energy. That's quite a topic. What could dark matter be? Because the ideas have changed over time quite significantly. My first thought when I heard about this crazy thing called dark matter is, well, isn't there's a ton of dwarf stars. Aren't there really faint stars that we just can't see? I mean, those are the most numerous stars anyway. What about black holes? I mean, there's got to be stuff that we know about that's made of normal matter that's out there that we just can't see. Actually, people have tried to measure this directly. Mm-hmm. And if you try to find things that you can't see that are normal matter, so black holes, you can see its effects through kind of this lensing effect or those objects' effects on other things, or you can simulate how many there should be just based on how clouds collapse and form stars. And the answer is there is some out there. I mean, there's obviously some of these objects out there that we haven't seen, but at most that could only make up a small fraction of what dark matter is. So there's still a heck of a lot more dark matter out there. There's a lot more effects of gravity that we still don't know what causes them.
The observations are now so compelling that either there is a vast amount of extra stuff or our understanding of gravity is wrong.
There's our other option.
And, you know,
Einstein. Psh.
Einstein, it would be great if he wasn't right for once.
Nice try, man.
What was that?
Oh, I get so many emails from people who are like, you have to read my new theory. Einstein is wrong, and I have proved it. This is just never going to stop. And so, of course, when we started to find this dark matter, people genuinely thought maybe our theory of gravity is not right. Maybe it needs to be modified
a little
bit.
And that's exciting. I mean, this is super cool.
Let's test it out.
We want to test. We want to push our understanding. We want to delve deeper and to understand the world around us better. And breaking Einstein's theories would be an amazing moment if that were the
case.
So we have one candidate, a class of theory called modified Newtonian dynamics, or MOND.
MOND.
Pretty popular in the 80s, 90s. It was already on the way out by the time I was getting my PhD.
MOND is out. So we do not have tiny little normal matter objects like small stars and black holes that are making up dark matter. We do not have this modified Newtonian dynamics that's making up dark matter. What other object is there? Something that we haven't been able to detect yet.
Yeah.
Potentially a tiny little particle that's zooming through you all the time.
It's a new particle. That much I'm pretty confident about. It is outside.
Wait, new as in like, you know, it just kind of came along recently. New as in we haven't detected yet.
We have definitely not detected it, or at least not in a way that everyone is convinced by. There are many candidates for this dark matter, essentially because as a theorist, if you propose a candidate particle and it ends up being the dark matter particle, boom, Nobel Prize time.
We're done.
So why wouldn't you have a punt? Just have a guess, create a particle candidate.
You can make science sound so easy.
So any theorist worth their salt have come up with a particle.
I think I've got an idea. Bowerinium.
I was totally going to go for the Duffy particle, but okay.
I pretty much could have guessed that.
Yep.
We've already got the Duffy milkshake. I think we can't go for a Duffy particle as well. Bowerinium. Bowerlino.
Ooh, Bowerlino.
Yeah.
Nice.
Just got to figure out what it is.
The wind of dark matter that's passing through us right now, very occasionally and quite possibly in the time that we've been speaking, has knocked out one atom, perhaps, from one of our listeners' bodies.
Feel that tickle?
That's a cozy thought, right? You've lost an atom. Now, this interaction is familiar to anyone who has watched snooker or played pool or whatever, and that is as simple as one ball goes in at speed, hits another, and kicks that ball out. This is one dark matter particle going in at speed, huge speed, 230 kilometers a second, and knocks the nucleus, the center little ball in your atom, flying. You don't notice that. We make for very poor dark matter detectors. But there are other types of material that are super sensitive to that. One example is a type of crystal, a salt crystal, sodium iodide. And if you dope it with thallium, you can get this crystal to emit a little bit of light. It will glow when it's struck by this dark matter.
And essentially, you have to put that down deep under the Earth because you have other particles, cosmic rays, and things that could hit it and could give you false detections.
Oh, this thing would glow constantly because of the radiation from space. You have to get it at least a kilometer below the surface to have all of that rock between you and the radiation from space, these exploding stars, these feeding black holes producing these weird cosmic rays. That kilometer worth of rock should block all of that radiation, but this ghost-like dark matter should make its way through without any issues. And there in the dark, you're looking at a crystal that you hope will glow as it's struck by a ghost. How cool is that?
Another option is you can try to create a dark matter particle.
In
the Large Hadron Collider, you are creating beams of energy that you're crashing together. So you know how much energy is going into these reactions. And then your detectors are trying to measure the energy that's coming out of all those reactions. And if you're missing a little bit of energy, then there's a chance that that could be this ghost dark matter particle.
Just flew through your detector, never triggering it.
Yeah.
It is the most exciting accountancy I can ever imagine. Look, I have a sneaking suspicion the Large Hadron Collider won't be able to detect dark matter.
It hasn't yet. It hasn't created it and then detected it.
Or not detected it. This is a worldwide effort involving theorists, involving astronomers on the biggest telescopes in the world, involving the biggest particle physics experiments in the world. It involves the biggest supercomputers to create these universes, to make these predictions, to change the properties of the dark matter and hope that that gives a visible impact on the forming galaxies. There are so many people attacking this dark matter problem from so many directions. That's actually why I'm super confident. I'm going to make a call 10 years from now. We will have the dark matter particle. We will know what it is.
I'll be pretty disappointed if we don't have it in, say, 5 years.
Oh!
So I'll just throw that out there.
I think that's pretty cocky, kid. So, seriously, Star Wars reference? Don't get cocky, kid? No. 5 years, 10 years. I think every scientist in the field is pretty confident it's real, it's there, and we're on the verge of detecting it. And that is extraordinarily exciting.
That's all the cosmic vertigo we've got for you this time. I'm Amanda Bauer.
And I'm Alan Duffy.
And this is produced by Joel Werner.
In the next episode, this happens.
You could not see my eyes roll.
So,
Matthew McConaughey.
Matthew McConaughey.